From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Congress is forging ahead on a relief bill with a nearly $2 trillion price tag. House Democrats hammered out the details of President Biden's plan last week while senators were occupied with the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. This bill includes $1,400 payments to most Americans, but it has a few more hurdles to clear before President Biden can actually sign it into law. Let's bring in NPR congressional editor Deidre Walsh, joins us now with more. And Deidre, Biden has wanted to get direct payments out since day one of his administration. So what's the latest in this draft?
Good afternoon. Well, those $1,400 payments are in the House package that Democrats are finalizing this week. There was a push from centrist Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and some others to make those payments more targeted. But House Democrats are keeping the stimulus payments structured basically the same way they were for the last round. Individuals making up to $75,000 a year and couples making up to $150,000 a year are going to be eligible for the full $1,400 check. They are phased out for those making $100,000 a year or $200,000 for couples. They would not be getting a check. But those payments are viewed as a critical component in the relief package and a campaign promise President Biden has said he will not break. That, along with money for vaccine distribution and state and local governments, are the key pieces in the relief bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Deidre, I want to ask you about something else. Congressional Democrats are using this budgetary maneuver to make this effort law without Republican support. Does that limit them in any way?
It does. There are certain limits that come along with this process known as budget reconciliation. House Democrats are putting together this $1.9 trillion bill, and they did include a $15 an hour federal minimum wage bill in their version. But the rules you referenced could mean that it won't be allowed, that the Senate parliamentarian may have to strip it out. So it could have to move as a separate standalone bill.
Okay, we'll be following that for sure. Congress is mostly out this week. They're observing President's Day today. So when's the soonest this bill could actually move forward?
They're working on the bill, as you said, this week, and the Democrats have a slim majority in the House. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is planning to bring the House back next week, and she's optimistic they will pass it and send it to the Senate.
All right. That's NPR congressional editor Deidre Walsh. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, millions of Americans are shivering in snow, ice, and freezing cold temperatures as a dangerous winter storm moves across the country. In Texas, the storm warning is in effect for much of the state. Some areas could see 10 inches of snow, and more than 2 million people there didn't have power as of this morning. Dominic Walsh is with Texas Public Radio. He's in San Antonio. And Dominic, this is very rare for Texas. What sort of havoc is it causing where you are?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. San Antonio, where I'm at, definitely has never seen anything like this, at least in a few decades, you know, anywhere from 2 inches to half a foot of snow. Most highways are closed in certain segments. A lot of roads are closed. Officials are urging people to stay home. It's not safe to drive. And just in San Antonio right now, more than 200,000 people are without power. Those rolling blackouts began about 12 hours ago.
Well, and it's bad across the state. I was just looking at the weather report this morning. 1 degree in Amarillo there in the panhandle, yeah. 17 degrees in El Paso, 19 in Houston. And as you say, millions of people without power across the state this morning. What are you hearing from them? How are people coping when the temperatures are that low?
You know, there's lots of layered clothing and crossed fingers that these blackouts don't last too long. But the thing about these blackouts, they tend to last 10 to 40 minutes. So officials are messaging, you know, just hang tight. Power will be back on soon. If your power is off for more than a few hours, there's probably an outage in your area, a down line. They're asking that you call in and report that if that's the case.
Oh, I see. So that's good to hear that people are getting their power back, at least on a rolling basis. That does make sense.
Right.
So what help is the state getting to dig out and eventually get the power back on for everybody?
So the White House has approved Texas's disaster declaration that frees up some resources from FEMA. But, you know, right now that main concern are these rolling blackouts. It's a problem of demand and supply. The source of the power has been impacted by the weather and people want to heat their homes at the same time. You have less supply, more demand. That's not something that can be addressed very quickly.
Yeah. What's in the forecast for you there across Texas? When are things going to warm up?
I mean, it depends where you are. Here in San Antonio, we're looking at maybe 2 to 3 days before we start to see temperatures rise above the freezing level. But the further north you go, I mean, they're looking until the weekend before there'll be a chance for this ice and snow to melt away.
Hmm. Dominic, we have just a little bit of time here left, but I know the roads have been a major mess. I think the police chief in Houston said just as of last night, there was like 130 crashes on the roads in the Houston area. What are you seeing when you go outside? What's it like on the streets?
I mean, so just looking out my window right now, the snow has started to melt a little bit, but it's turning into an icy slush. And, you know, temperatures are going to remain below freezing for the next few days. That's exactly why officials are urging people to stay home. These roads are not safe to drive on right now.
All right. Reporter Dominic Walsh with Texas Public Radio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some landlords are evicting tenants despite a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention moratorium that was supposed to last until the end of March. In Georgia, for instance, a couple of judges won't even acknowledge the eviction moratorium in their courts, which leaves tenants with no option but to move. Stephanie Stokes of member station WABE reports.
Katie Dern liked living in Carroll County. She grew up in another rural part of West Georgia, and she wanted the same quiet lifestyle for her four kids.
That's what I like, you know, walking down a dirt road to get on the school bus.
So when her family found a townhome community near a lake in Carroll County a couple of years ago, it seemed like a good fit.
It was completely furnished, and it was a beautiful place. So yeah, but this pandemic really messed up our lives, like a whole lot.
She and her husband both lost work. Duren from the mall, her husband as a mechanic. They were out of work for several months while they waited for unemployment, which still hasn't come through.
So we fell behind. We had to find a new job. And it went downhill fast from there.
Eventually, their landlord filed for eviction. That's when her husband learned about the order from the CDC. It bans landlords from evicting tenants who are behind on rent during the pandemic. Dern's family filled out the CDC form showing they qualified before their court hearing.
We even went and got the paper notarized. That way, you know, the judge knew that we did everything we were supposed to in a timely manner.
She says they showed up to the small brick courthouse in Carroll County feeling confident until they approached the judge. According to Dern, he didn't even look at the CDC paper. He told them Carroll County doesn't honor that.
I mean, he should have just ripped it up and threw it in the trash, because that's how I felt when he said that.
That judge was Carroll County Chief Magistrate Alton Johnson.
The CDC, as far as I know, has no control over Georgia courts.
He's one of at least two county judges in Georgia who are allowing evictions despite the CDC order. The CDC claims it has the authority to stop evictions because there's a public health emergency. Johnson told me he just doesn't believe that authority is greater than the state's.
It seems that you're in the minority in terms of how you're interpreting the CDC order, at least in Georgia. My understanding is that most judges are recognizing it.
I understand that.
Why do you think so many other judges have come to different conclusions than you?
I don't know. I think that if the federal government wanted to do this correctly, they would have done it by passing a law stating this is what we're going to do, and properly compensate those that are out of resources or money.
He says he believes the federal eviction moratorium violates landlords' rights.
Certainly, no one likes to kick someone out of their home. But then again, when you have somebody who owes a mortgage, is it fair for that individual to bear the burden of what should be a government's responsibility? Now, that's the way I look at it.
Johnson says he could be wrong. He's invited tenants to appeal to a higher court. But that's harder than it sounds, according to Susan Reeve. She works to prevent evictions at Georgia Legal Services. She says state law requires tenants pay the rent they owe while the appeal is pending or leave the home.
Most of our clients, when they realize they're not going to be able to remain in possession, have to focus their energies on finding housing and alternative arrangements for their family rather than focusing on an appeal.
And they have little other recourse at the federal level. They can wait to see if the U.S. Justice Department will enforce the CDC moratorium. The order mentions landlords who violate it could face a $100,000 fine.
But that doesn't keep someone housed. That doesn't prevent someone from going into a shelter. And it doesn't prevent the spread of the virus.
And preventing the spread of COVID-19 was the justification for the CDC order. COVID-19 made Katie Dern's situation even more difficult. Judge Johnson ordered she leave the property and pay back $5,000 in rent. Soon after, her family tested positive for the virus. Duren said they were still sick when the six of them moved into their SUV. It was two nights before they got enough money for the hotel where they're staying now. Duren is still confused about her family's experience in court.
The CDC, which is federal, said that, you know, if we did all of these things, then we couldn't be evicted. But this one county decided that they could make their own rules.
So this is her conclusion.
I don't advise anybody to move to Carroll County, move to another county.
She says her family plans to leave as soon as they can. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Stokes.
Would you be more willing to go to a restaurant if you knew everyone working there had been vaccinated against COVID-19? Jason Berry hopes so. He's founder of Need Hospitality and Design in Washington, D.C. The restaurant company is planning to pay its workers to get vaccinated. Berry is joining other companies like Dollar General, McDonald's, Trader Joe's, and the Olive Garden by compensating workers to get a shot. Jason Berry, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And what's the plan? How are you going to make this work for your employees?
Well, we wanted to have an opportunity to encourage everybody to get vaccinated. And I think the restaurant industry employees are a unique group because they're generally very young. They feel that they're going to live forever, as many young people do, and don't always have health insurance and don't always take good care of themselves. And so given that the virus has not focused on young people as much as older people and people with pre-existing conditions, we had to find a way to encourage our teammates to take better care of themselves. And so we came up with a plan to incentivize them to get vaccinated. And the plan is pretty simple. If you are an hourly employee, you're going to receive 4 hours of extra pay at your regular wage rate. And if you're a salaried employee, we're going to give you an extra day of paid vacation.
And help me do the math here just a little bit. So what kind of dollar figure does that look like for a typical hourly employee?
Minimum wage here is $15 an hour. The majority of our employees are tipped employees, so they receive minimum wage. We have about 320 employees right now. And I don't have a calculator in front of me, but my guess is right around, you know, $20,000. Plus the salary employees adds a whole lot more. We have about 30 of those.
So who's eligible? Is it everyone from your office workers to the bus staff and bartenders, everybody?
Any employee, yep, absolutely.
All right, so the other question is, when are they going to be eligible to get these shots? Because right now, not all frontline workers can get in line.
Well, we were supposed to be eligible February 1st. Of course, vaccines are pretty delayed, unfortunately, and hospitality is one of the essential groups, but not obviously at the top of the list.
Okay, so that's got to happen first before any of this can happen. But, you know, there are
absolutely
two reasons that I can think of doing something like this. Number one, it's probably good business for you. And number two, it's probably just the ethical, the right thing to do. How did you make the decision here to do this?
Well, definitely the latter was number one. It's the right thing to do for our teammates, given the concerns we have. And this is really one of the only businesses that I can think of where you're exposed to people with their mask off. You have to take your mask off to eat. And our staff, you know, stays away from the tables as much as possible, but they have to visit the tables to bring them food and drink. And so that was really important to us to find a way to help protect our teammates. And secondly, you're right, it is good business. And I'm hoping that sharing what we're doing, what some other companies are doing, that we can encourage others in our industry to get their teammates vaccinated. I think that we need to find a way to communicate to the public that it's safe to eat in restaurants. And one of the ways we can do that is by sharing that our teammates are vaccinated. And, you know, just like the health department in many cities will put a letter grade in your window, perhaps there's a way to say this restaurant is 96% staff vaccinated or something along those lines to encourage people to enter our restaurant and feel safe that they can eat there.
Is part of the issue that you're trying to overcome vaccine hesitancy on your staff? Have you heard of that? Do you think this would help?
You know, I haven't heard directly from any of our staff that they're vaccine hesitant. I'm sure there are some when you have a population of, you know, 320. But yes, we feel that as the leaders of the company, if we believe in vaccines and we believe in science and health, hopefully they'll follow our lead if they're wishy-washy on what to do and take the vaccines when they're offered to them.
And have you had any outbreaks of COVID since the pandemic started inside your restaurants?
No outbreaks. In fact, not one contact tracing event since we reopened our restaurants in early June has occurred in any of our restaurants. And I'm really proud of that. We've had people that have had to, you know, take time off because they may have caught COVID from some other place, but no contracted cases in the restaurants that we're aware of.
You know, Jason, for a year now almost, I've been speaking with restaurant owners who've just taken a huge, huge hit financially, emotionally. Some are barely hanging on. Some have closed. But it's interesting because you appear to be doing quite well, and I see that you're opening several more restaurants this year. How are you able to pull that off at this time?
Well, we've got great investors. We've got great brokers who help us find locations, and we have a good reputation. You know, I thought on March 16th last year when all of my restaurants were closed, I thought my career was over and I have to go find a new job. It wasn't quite that simple, but it was one of the most emotional days I've had in my life. Once the dust settled a little bit and the government helped with the PPP immensely, the SBA helped with loans, and our landlords have been really good. We're fortunate enough to have big waterfront restaurants with a lot of patio space, and our landlords gave us more space to use so that we could get more tables outside. So there have been a few silver linings to this terrible cloud over our industry, but we're just happy to have our employees employed and our restaurants exist, and we know that we're going to come back from this hopefully this spring or summer as the world starts to settle post-vaccine and come out of this pandemic. Hmm.
Jason Berry, founder of Need Hospitality and Design. It's a Washington, D.C. restaurant company that will pay its workers to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Jason, thank you very much for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Public health leaders on the local level are usually low profile, but in this pandemic, many of them, especially in rural areas, are the public faces of the shutdown. And that's made them into targets of angry social media campaigns, of protests outside of their home, even death threats. Colorado Public Radio's Andrea Dukakis has the story from that state.
It was another week of constant work, no sleep, irate citizens. In December, near the holidays, Megan Hillman decided she needed something, anything, to feel good about her job as public health director.
I went out and gave vaccine at the nursing home because we are beat down.
Hillman was a physician assistant in her old life. Now she heads up public health in two rural counties on Colorado's Eastern Plains.
We were crying, like happy crying. It's so nice to be able to do something that is appreciated and you're told thank you.
Hillman hasn't heard a lot of thank yous since the pandemic began. She has gotten angry letters, emails, threats about COVID-19 restrictions. One threat the sheriff and district attorney investigated. On the other side of the state, the threats came home for Leanne Jalan. She's the public health director for two counties in the Southwest, a career she took up after being a social worker and a nurse. Last month, she was working at home on a Zoom call with local officials.
But then I kind of heard just some voices and something that I couldn't quite make out. And then I heard a loud banging. And so at the loud banging, I went into my window.
Outside, she saw about 20 protesters. 6 feet from her door, there was a man holding a huge sign that said, "End the lockdown."
And he was yelling, "A bad person lives here."
She told the officials on Zoom what was happening, then hung up and called the chief of police. Law enforcement came. Jalan says the protesters left after a few hours. There were no arrests.
I don't love being in this pandemic any more than anybody else. I don't love wearing masks. I miss seeing my friends and family. I miss going over to people's houses. I miss hugging people. I miss eating at restaurants. But this is my job. And if I didn't do the things that I'm doing as a public health director, I would be negligent in my duties.
Ironically, Jalon says she's also faced threats from people who don't think the COVID-19 restrictions go far enough. Jalon has faced this outpouring of anger for many months, just like her counterpart in Gunnison County, Joni Reynolds. Police have been monitoring threats against her since April. On the day of the insurrection in D.C., Reynolds heard about a new post on social media.
I mean, they just talked about what to do with me and whether they should sue me or whether they should have a protest at my house or whether they should hang me from a branch of justice.
Stories like this from Reynolds, Jalon, and Hillman have led to what one public official calls a brain drain since the pandemic began. And it's happening across the country. Lori Freeman is the CEO of the National Association of County and City Health Workers.
And it doesn't really matter whether it's a red or a blue state or county, or whether it's rural, urban, suburban.
Nationally, more than 80 public health officials have resigned or been fired since the start of the pandemic. Here in Colorado, about a dozen of the state's 53 public health directors have left their jobs. That trend has caught the attention of state lawmakers like Democratic Representative Yadira Caraveo.
In the middle of a pandemic, it's really concerning to lose that expertise because these individuals aren't allowed to do their jobs safely because they're having to worry about if somebody's going to target their family or themselves.
Caraveo plans to sponsor a bill to protect the personal information of state and local healthcare workers. It won't fix the problem altogether, especially in the short term. But Leanne Jalon says she plans to see it through.
There is a job that needs to get done. We have a mission right now. I am committed to seeing through that mission.
And to seeing an end to COVID-19 in Southwest Colorado. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Dukakis.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from HomeTap, the smart way to access your home's equity and pay for life's expenses without a loan. With HomeTap, receive cash in as little as 3 weeks and use it for anything you'd like, from paying off debt to funding renovations and more. Plus, you don't have to deal with monthly payments or interest. Learn more about HomeTap and get a personalized estimate at HomeTap.com.
There is so much Black excellence in the sciences that we want to celebrate. So in honor of Black History Month, all this week, Shortwave is featuring conversations with Black scientists and educators, people doing incredible work and pushing for a world where science serves everyone. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
The CEOs of Reddit and the trading app Robinhood are set to testify before Congress this week as part of the investigation into the recent rally of GameStop shares. The brick-and-mortar video game company's stock jumped by 500% last month after amateur traders on Reddit fueled the surge. Now the government is looking into whether there was market manipulation involved. And for more, we're joined by Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hey, Robin.
Hey, Tanya.
Okay, so a month ago seems so long ago. Remind us what happened with GameStop's stock last month and what it's looking like right now.
That's right. The video game retailer, it's seen better days. Even so, it saw its stock soar in value as an army of Redditors bought and praised it, the better to smoke out short sellers who were betting on its collapse. So you saw panic buying ensue. And what was a $2.50 stock last year, Tanya, it briefly touched $483. I mean, it's since back down to $52, but GameStop, as we know, has now become synonymous with Revenge of the Little Guy versus Wall Street.
Right. And the House and Financial Services Committee will hold this hearing on Thursday to probe whether the GameStop rally was caused by illegal market manipulation. I mean, Robinhood is also facing lawsuits for restricting trading during the surge. Why do lawmakers suspect there was, I guess, a lack of a better way to say it, foul play involved?
Consider GameStop's corporate reality. Its shuttering stores, malls remain empty. Even outside of COVID, its business was fleeing to e-commerce. And Bricks and mortar leases and overhead became an albatross. But what did change is the paper value of this enterprise. At its Robin Hood peak, GameStop was somehow worth over $20 billion, and real hedge funds took billions in losses. So lawmakers, they're typically late to market shifts. They're now wondering how that value just happens. In theory, at least, in an efficient or mostly rational market, you don't just have tens of billions of dollars whiplashing back and forth over nothing, over words.
There's also this Reddit user known as Roaring Kitty who's been called to testify. What is his role in all of this?
You could imagine some senior congressman going, "Oh, I'm Roaring Kitty, what do you have to say for yourself?" I mean, so much of this has crossed into the surreal. There's already screenplay treatments being bandied about. Roaring Kitty is the screen name for a young day trader, Keith Gill, who carried the torch for GameStop Army on the now infamous Reddit forum. There's an element of anti-hero here. Little guy accumulating the shares. He posts YouTube videos, hyping the story from his screen in Massachusetts. And so regulators now want to check on how that all went down. Gill, for his part, he's told the press that he was preaching fundamental value for GameStop, that it wasn't headed the way of Blockbuster Video.
Okay, I have less than a minute with you. We talked about the House and Financial Services Committee hearing. The Department of Justice and the Securities Exchange and Commission is also looking into this GameStop saga. What do we know about those investigations?
Yeah, the DOJ is investigating possible market manipulation or criminal misconduct with the SEC. Also on the case, of course, Reddit prides itself on anonymity. If anything, its Wall Street Bets forum has only swelled in popularity in the past few months. Membership, Tanya, it's approaching 9 million users, four times where it was to start the year.
9 million. Wow. That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you so much, Robin.
My pleasure.
The Grammy Awards are less than a month away, and jazz musician Maria Schneider has a chance to add to her collection. She's won 5 Grammys and is nominated for 2 more, including Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album for Data Lords, her release with the Maria Schneider Orchestra. She spoke with Robin Young when Data Lords came out last August, and today we're going to listen to it again.
We're used to big sounds and big thoughts from jazz musician Maria Schneider with her Maria Schneider Orchestra. She's created pieces like the Grammy-winning Cerulean Skies, which took bird sounds and incorporated them into a large, lush work reflecting her middle-of-the-country roots. But Maria Schneider's new release has even broader scope. Data Lords is a double album that takes on both the digital and natural world as subjects, one CD each. Here's the title track. Data Lords by the Maria Schneider Orchestra and other places on the double album. She returns to something more familiar, an almost reverential homage to the nature poetry of Ted Kooser. What are we saying here? Maria Schneider joins us now by Skype with more. Maria, so good to speak with you again.
It's great to speak with you too.
You know, it feels to me like this album is somehow made for this moment because we all are really having to confront the digital world in ways many people didn't have to depend on it before. If you're working from home, yearning for nature, you know, this collision is kind of in the moment, even though you started the project before it. What made you think of it?
Well, I think as a musician, this is an issue that confronted my life and the lives of everybody in the creative community, filmmakers and everything, as we started to see our work shared for free. And we all became pretty early on, or at least I did, aware that what this was really about was using creative work as a carrot for gathering data by big data companies. And it took us, I think, a long time to understand as a society, and I think most people don't, how powerful that data is. And that it's not a small thing for us to trade free products for information from our private lives that can be used against us.
Which is why the cut data lords sounds so ominous, you know. But let's listen to a little of the first track of the digital world. This is called A World Lost. You've said in the liner notes that this is kind of about kids being wrapped up in their devices, losing touch with the ability to look out a window. Again, with kids having to stay at home in so many places, this really resonates.
I think so. What I know about myself, and I remember when somebody first introduced me to email, they said, oh, you have to get email. And I remember when I wrote this person back, and as I thought about, oh, let me rewrite that sentence and do this or that, I thought, oh my God, this is going to suck the life out of my life if suddenly I have to communicate on this level with Lord knows how many people. And as a creative person, what is really important to me and just as a human is that silent space, even when it's uncomfortable. And I know as a kid, a lot of times I felt bored. I think in the liner notes I talk about looking out the window or, you know, sometimes just feeling horribly bored. And then we would go outside and we would start making things with stuff we found or whatever. And suddenly the world would become big and it would be full of creative ideas and things we dreamed of making and building. And I think that we are losing that expanse in our own lives. I think children are losing it, and I think adults are losing it. Mm.
It sounds like you're feeling something that a lot of people are feeling now, that we are trapped even more with our technology, again, in this moment than ever before. So I'm going to stay with this first album, which is, again, about the Data Lords, the technology CD. This cut is called Don't Be Evil, of course, Google's motto. Let's listen. I'm picturing big fat cat Silicon Valley executives. What are you saying here?
Well, it's mocking them, and it's mocking that aspirational motto, don't be evil. And you can't set the bar lower than don't be evil. And I feel that they haven't even managed to make it to that low bar even.
This is so interesting because, again, you wrote all of this music before the moment that we're in right now when people are boycotting Facebook because of the way it spreads hate speech. You seem to be on to something in the digital world, which is, again, the one of two albums in your new release, The Data Lords. And then there's Our Natural World, the second album. Let's have a little taste. This is Bluebird. What are you saying here?
Well, the second side of this album, all of this, I'll start by just saying, came quite naturally. The music just came out of me, and what the music was showing me is this polarization that I am struggling with in my own life. To stay connected to the natural world sometimes means, you know what, I'm just going to leave my phone at home. And making that decision and then reconnecting. When I turn those devices off and I make that decision to have that space, then I find myself reconnecting to all those beautiful things, poetry, art, nature, just, you know, that expansive world that is full of questions and unknowns and inspiration. And and art, you know. So this, the pieces on that side of the album are all coming out of those things that are most important to me.
Yeah. There's another piece that just, it's like a prayer that, I didn't mean to invoke Madonna, you know, it really, it's like a real prayer. It takes its title from the poem March 20th by the poet Ted Kooser. Let's listen. There?
I can say it. I know it. It must be to someone that I am alive and walking and that I have written these poems. This morning the sun stood right at the end of the road and waited for me.
Ooh.
Yeah, to me it's an affirmation that this world, this life, the sun, good things are at the end of that road and they're waiting for us. If we look up, if we have our eyes up and looking to each other and within ourselves to connect to ourselves and what's important to ourselves, to our world, and to each other. It's my hopeful message at the end of the album.
Grammy-winning jazz musician Maria Schneider speaking with Robin Young about her Grammy-nominated album, Data Lords. The ceremony is on March 14th. This is Here and Now. Scientists in Antarctica have discovered life flourishing in some of the most inhospitable conditions on Earth. Researchers drilled through more than half a mile of ice, plunged a camera another 1,600 feet down to the seafloor, and were stunned to discover sponge-like animals clinging to a rock. Not only is it pitch black and ice cold, scientists didn't think there'd be enough food down there. The discovery has been published in the journal Frontiers in Marine Science, and the lead author joins me now, Hugh Griffiths, a marine biologist with the British Antarctic Survey. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And you were actually looking for something else when you were boring through the ice shelf to get to the ocean floor. Can you explain that process first?
It's even worse. I wasn't even there. I was on a ship about 700 miles away in Antarctica doing a completely different project. And a bunch of geologists were sat on the ice in tents, really freezing themselves to do some hot water drilling through 900 meters of ice and then a further 500 meters of seawater to collect a mud sample, a sediment sample from underneath the ice shelf so that they could have a look at what the past environment was like. And unfortunately for them, they failed three times to even collect any mud. And when they put a GoPro on the equipment they were putting down, they saw that it was hitting a large boulder right beneath the hole that they drilled. So it was a huge amount of effort to get nothing.
Yeah, so they weren't getting the mud they were looking for because they were hitting rock, right? So what did they find on that rock?
Well, they thought it was just a massive inconvenience, but they did then later see that around the edges they could see a few strange shapes, and they weren't really sure what they were. So when they got back eventually to the UK, they showed us biologists what they'd found. And initially I looked at it and thought, oh, it's a couple of sponges on a rock, big deal. And then they showed me a map of where they'd collected the images from. And that was hundreds of kilometers away from any potential food source for these sponges.
Can you just describe the conditions down there? Because this was incredibly surprising, not that you found these particular sponges there, but that you found anything at all, right?
Yeah, so it's completely dark. It's the equivalent of 1,200 meters down under the ocean, but it's got 900 meters of ice above it. So there's no light getting through, but there's also no food raining down from above. So any food they get is coming in sideways, but it's also minus 2 degrees centigrade down there. And so you end up with a really inhospitable place to live.
What do these sponges look like? I'm just wondering if they're a completely new species.
Well, they could well be completely new species. Even in the kind of more open parts of Antarctica, about 10 to 20% of what we catch is new to science. So that's phenomenal for anywhere in the world. But if you go into the deep sea, then those numbers shoot up to about 80 or 90% in the Antarctic region. And these animals look like they're more like deep sea species. And also the environment resembles the deep sea a lot more. So we don't think they're the same things as we're finding out on the shelf. But until we actually manage to get our hands on one, we'll never be able to answer that question.
So one of the reasons that this is so surprising is that you're saying that the food they get is likely coming sideways, drifting sideways through the current from very far distances. Is that right?
Yes. And these tiny particles of food have got to stay in the water column long enough to go over 1,000 kilometers and then bump into a sponge at the end of it. So the chances of getting food are really low. So that raises questions about how often are these animals even feeding? So we know that some Antarctic sponges can live a very long time, even up to tens of thousands of years. So are these things only feeding once a year or once a decade or once a century? Really, until we get our hands on them again, it's not going to be possible to answer those kind of questions.
Just amazing. Makes me think that there's still a lot that we don't know about life in the ocean. So what should our takeaways be from this discovery?
For me, the really exciting thing is that we have this habitat that is, the Antarctic ice shelves cover about a third of the continental shelf. So that's something close to 1.6 million square kilometers. And what we've seen so far of it with our cameras down boreholes is about the size of a tennis court. So we've got this enormous part of the world's seafloor that we know nothing about, really. So to go there and find something that we didn't think could live there really makes it even more exciting as a habitat. And the challenge is to go and find out more mean that we're going to have to develop new technologies and new ways of working just to even get a window into their world. So as a scientist, it's really kind of the same as trying to find life in space or at the bottom of the deepest part of the ocean. It's that kind of challenge.
Well, and that habitat that they're living in is under, directly under, a huge ice sheet that we know is threatened by climate change. Do you think there's a chance we could lose the chance to learn more about these animals before it's too late?
Well, we've already lost two floating ice shelves, two enormous bits of ice in my lifetime. So, and I'm only 44. So the chances of more ice shelves going are increasing as the world warms. Luckily, the one that we found this under is one of the bigger and more stable ones that is further south. But it's only a matter of time, if we carry on the way we are, that we're going to damage Antarctica's environment irreparably, and we're going to end up losing some of these ice shelves before we've even looked underneath them at this rate. Mm.
Well, the video of your camera going through that ice and then emerging into the ocean is worth a look. We're going to post it at hereandnow.org. Hugh Griffiths, a marine biologist with the British Antarctic Survey, thank you so much. Fascinating.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.